I bring you greetings and peace from your friends and neighbors at First Congregational United Church of Christ here in Appleton. And I want to offer special thanks for the kind welcome that you and especially Pastor Leah has offered me to your fellowship. When Pastor Roger and I talked several months ago about this exchange of pulpits between the two of us, we thought it would be a wonderful way to celebrate the close relationship that has long existed between our two congregations. This may be due in part to the small tide of members that seem to ebb and flow between our two congregations. But more than that, we have been partners over the years in countless ecumenical interfaith ventures, worship services, mission projects, habitat builds, protests. We are kindred, our two congregations, because of our common roots in the immigrant stories of the Puritans and the Pilgrims. We are kindred because of our common history in the abolitionist, women's suffrage, and civil rights movements. We are kindred because of our common interest in justice and our common disinterest in orthodoxy. You probably know the story of the three children who were invited in Sunday school or in school to bring a show and tell project to talk about their own religious tradition. And the first boy said, "I'm Jewish, and this is a menorah." And the little girl said, "I'm Catholic, and these are rosary beads." And the third little boy said, "I'm Congregationalist, and this is a tuna noodle casserole." So I want to thank you for welcoming me into the potluck of faith that is your fellowship. And thank you for accepting the casserole of my own thoughts on the subject of awe this morning. So, what is it that fills you with a feeling of awe, a sense of wonder? What is it that makes your eyes widen, your jaw drop, your mind open, and time stop? What is it that makes your heart sing and your hands and feet tingle to act with new possibility? Here's how Petty Ann Rogers describes her answer. "Some say it's the reptilian dance of the purple-tongued sand goanna, for there the magnificent translation of tenacity into bone and grace occurs. Others, for grandeur, choose the terror of lightning peals on prairies or the tall collapsing cathedrals of stormy seas, because there they feel dwarfed and appropriately helpless. Others select the serenity of that ceiling cellar of stars they see at night on placid lakes, because there they feel assured and universally magnanimous." How would you answer the question? What is it that does it for you? Landscapes? Seascapes? Starscapes? None of these is the answer that ultimately Patty Ann Rogers chooses. She concludes this way: "But it is the dark emptiness contained in every next moment that seems to me the most singularly glorious gift. That void, which one is free to fill with processions of men bearing burning cedar knots, or with parades of blue horses belled and ribboned and stepping sideways, with tumbling white-faced mimes, or companies of black-robed choristers, to fill simply with hammered silver teapots or kiln-dried crockery, tangerine and almond custards, polonaises, polkas, whittling sticks, wailing walls. That space large enough to hold all invented blasphemies and pieties, 10,000 definitions of God and more, never fully filled. Never." What is it that fills you with a sense of wonder, a feeling of awe? What makes your eyes widen, your jaw drop, your mind open, and time stop? What makes your heart sing and your hands and feet tingle to act with new possibility? What is it that makes you want to line up in a procession of passionate hope, ready to fill the space of wonder in your own heart, in the life of this community and the world? The most moving and wonder-filled procession I've ever witnessed didn't take place during a wedding service or a college graduation or a royal coronation. The most moving and wonderful processional I've ever seen took place this summer at a church in Wayzata, Minnesota. In fact, it takes place every Sunday when they opened the worship for their parable service, a worship service that's specifically designed for special needs people and their families. The chapel was filled with more than 100 folk, young kids in wheelchairs or wearing leg braces or led by companion dogs, older folks with walkers in their hands or adult children at their arms, folks across the spectrum of physical and cognitive ability, people labeled by words like autism and dementia. The pastor came into the chapel and said, "Who wants to take part in the procession?" And a kind of riotous roar rose from the crowd. And just about everybody spilled out into the hallway. All those walkers and wheelchairs, dogs and kids, parents and adult children. Each of them was given a drum or a noisemaker of some kind. And the pianist started playing "When the Saints Go Marching In." And in they came, marching, the saints of God, marching and rolling and shuffling and limping, and all of them singing or shouting, laughing, banging, singing. How could I keep from crying in joy and wonder, awed by the life and the love and the hope and the spirit that blossomed in that place? This is what fills me with wonder. The huge cathedral space inside of each one of us, no matter who, no matter what, that wants to be filled with laughter and song, with joy and wonder of the divine. Is there anything more human than our capacity for wonder? At the Wayzata Church, they call this worship service of special needs folks and their families parables, because they believe that every person is ultimately a parable, a sign and story of God's love and grace. How cool is that? And if Jesus is any indication, then the divine deals in parables. The divine is disclosed in parables. The divine delights in parables. Without a parable, he told them nothing, Matthew tells us in the reading that Leah just shared. And that's okay. Because if there is no deeper meaning, no wider resonance, no more urgent calling in a thing, then it isn't worth telling anyway. But Jesus has found something worth telling. On the hunt for wonders to serve as parables of the divine procession of love and justice, he comes up with two small examples. A mustard seed and leaven. The mustard seed is tiny, the smallest of all seeds, Matthew tells us. But notice its expansive growth in Jesus' telling. First into a shrub, and then, improbably, even impossibly, into a tree. It changes into a tree, all the better to provide a protective shelter for birds and their offspring. Similarly, with yeast or leaven, only a small amount is required to affect a large amount of dough. We're told the woman is preparing 3 measures of flour. That's over 50 pounds of flour, enough to feed 100 people with bread. Mustard seed and leaven, small things that lead to great effect. And folks like us should immediately think of those wonderful words of Margaret Mead, the anthropologist: "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." The wonder of small things is that small things can make a big difference. The science writer Malcolm Gladwell would agree. He recently published a book this last week called "David and Goliath: Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants." He begins with an analysis of the David and Goliath story in the Hebrew Scriptures, and then looks for modern examples of the underappreciated advantages of being the underdog, of how the small can gain a big edge. That's the wonder of small things, according to Gladwell and to Jesus and the world around us. But there's something else going on in these stories that Jesus tells. The subjects of these parables, mustard seed and leaven, not only share this theme of small to big, but they share something else as well. Both of them, leaven and mustard plants, are in Jewish tradition ritually unclean. unholy, unfit for the righteous to touch or handle. Leaven is unclean in contrast to the unleavened bread of the Passover. Leaven's presence in the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian New Testament is almost always universally negative. Even the Apostle Paul says so, contrasting the leaven of malice and evil with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. The only time leaven gets a positive mention is right here on Jesus' lips. The mustard plant was regarded as unclean in both Leviticus and in the Mishnah, and for obvious reasons. Here's how Pliny, the first century Roman natural historian, writes about the mustard plant. He says, "It grows entirely wild. When it has once been sown, it is scarcely possible to get the place free of it, as the seed, when it falls, germinates at once." Mustard plants are kudzu. They're purple loosestrife. That's what mustard plants are. They're invasive species that are tenacious in their presence and frustrate any attempt to fully get rid of them. No wonder they're thought of as unclean. No wonder any farmer that would actually sow a mustard seed in his field is thought of as crazy. Mustard seeds and leaven, small sources of large wonder. And unclean as well. What do you make of that? Could it be that some of the sources of wonder in this world are not just the small as well as the large, but they can be unlikely from a standpoint of power, prestige, piety, status? William Sloan Coffin, the wonderful UCC pastor and one-time Lawrence University professor, liked to tell the story of his friend, an old campaigner for peace and justice. He went on a hunger strike, this man, when he was in his 80s. He was protesting the policies of the Reagan administration, which had doubled the number of homeless folks living on the streets. You remember that time. For 2 weeks, this man in his 80s ate nothing as a statement of protest, but to little or no avail. It wasn't being covered by the media. The statement he was trying to make wasn't being heard. And as his hunger strike approached its third week, Coffin and several others of the man's friends approached him out of concern. They said, "You're not so young anymore. We're concerned about your health. Besides, this isn't changing anything. Your hunger strike isn't working." And the old man said to Coffin, "Some things you do to change the world. Other things you do so the world doesn't change you." Sounds like the kudzu of justice, doesn't it? You can't get rid of it. The leaven of our yearning for peace. It isn't pretty. It often isn't neat. It often doesn't seem effective. It costs too much. It demands too much from us sometimes. Sometimes it feels downright unclean, this yearning, aching for justice that we feel. But there it is, Jesus tells us. In you, in us, in the world, it won't be stopped. It can't be killed. I think there's something else to this as well, this image of the unclean. Mark Medoff, the director, actor, professor, playwright, author of the wonderful play Children of a Lesser God, if you remember that play, he tells of an experience he had in 1972 when he returned to Miami Beach High School to speak to the drama class there. It was old high school. "Afterwards, I asked the drama teacher if any of the English teachers were still there. Irene Roberts, he tells me, is in the class just down the hall. I was no one special in Miss Roberts' class, just another jock who did okay work. I don't recall any one special bit of wisdom that she passed on, yet I can't forget her respect for language, for ideas, for her students. I realize now, many years later, that she was the quintessential selfless teacher for me. I'd like to say something to her, but I don't want to pull her from a class." "Nonsense," he says. "I'd be delighted to introduce her, and she'll be delighted to see you." So the drama teacher brings Miss Roberts into the hallway where stands this 32-year-old man
that she had last saw at 18 years old. "I'm Mark Medoff," I tell her. "You were my 12th grade English teacher in 1958. She cocks her head at me as if this angle might conjure me in her memory. And then, though armed with a message I want to deliver in some perfect torrent of words, I can't think up anything more memorable than this. "I want you to know," I say, "you were important to me." And there in the hallway, this slight and lovely woman, now nearing retirement age, this teacher who doesn't remember me, begins to weep. And she encircles me in her arms. Remembering this moment, I begin to sense that everything I will ever know, everything I will ever pass to my students, to my children, is an inseparable part of the ongoing legacy of our shared wonder. The eternal hope that we can, must, make ourselves better. Irene Roberts holds me briefly in her arms and through her tears whispers against my cheek, "Thank you." And then with the briefest of looks into my forgotten face, she disappears back into her classroom, returns to what she has done thousands of days through all the years of my absence. Of course, I tell this story partly because we live in a time and a place where teaching is regarded with diminishing respect and esteem. Anyone can teach, we hear. It's the purple loose strife of professions. We go through cycles, it seems, we human beings, when teaching and truth, beauty and wisdom are sometimes held in contempt. It depends on our commitment to freedom, to prevailing political climate, our appetite for inconvenient truths. But we should and must resist such efforts to diminish the importance of learning, of teaching, of truth. For if wonder is what truly makes us human, what does it cost us to give up on wonder? Who was the one who first taught you about the periodic table or the Pythagorean theorem? The life cycle of a raindrop, the colony behavior of bees, the majesty of the Himalayas, the miracle that was Mozart, the poise and delicacy of the rings of Saturn, Van Gogh using great gobs of paint like blood spilled in madness. Who taught you about Shakespeare's To Be or Not to Be speech, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, Madison's Bill of Rights, Aesop's fables, Grimm's fairy tales, the teachings of Confucius, the parables of Jesus? Who first exposed you to these wonders? And while doing so, nurtured your very capacity to wonder, to be a human being? I want you to know, we should say to them, "You were important to me." We are here today, you and I, like Mark Medoff, the product of teachers and examples, parables of honest inquiry, patient observation, and passionate search. It was their sense of wonder that strengthened our own. I also believe that you and I are really like Irene Roberts, dutifully going about our daily business while harboring secret and not-so-secret thoughts that our labors are in vain. It is so seldom that we are told that we are important that we begin to believe that we too are small and unclean. Not big enough, not good enough to follow where wonder might lead us. It's not like these are new thoughts to us. You don't believe the right things. You don't have the right religion. You don't belong to the right clubs. You don't love the right people. You don't dress or talk or look or walk or think or vote the right way. Some of us have been told these things all of our lives, in the workplace or at school, in the neighborhood, in a family, in a house of worship. But look what you've done. Friends and family, co-workers and neighbors, parents, partners, children have found in you a wonder, a parable of divine love and grace. Look what you've meant and what you mean to those around you. You've leavened a loaf and 100 have been fed. You've spread out your branches and birds have made their home. That's the wonder of small things, including you. Amen.